following program is intended for mature audiences.
Are you ready? Are you ready?
December, a time of dark days, long nights, time of endings. We Americans saw a lot of endings this week. Tonight in particular, the finale of someone who I revere greatly, Stephen Colbert and the Colbert Report. Also this week was the ending of television show, which has meant a lot to me and we'll talk about. But there is a very personal message I'd like today about an ending that happened this week. As this month rolls on, and not only to its end, but the end of the year, a new one is waiting in the wings. Personally, a very important being in my life came to her end this week. Perhaps, in all seriousness, she was the love of my life. As my beloved tortoiseshell or tortie American short-haired cat, Mrs. Zuzu Petals, she died a couple of days ago. She was 22 years old. Every night for which I was in this house in Burbank, Zuzu Petals slept warmly against either my sternum or my belly. I remember the first few days Zuzu Petals ever spent at our house. She didn't know what to make of you. She was a feral cat, living in a barn, having no contact at all with our species until caught and given up for adoption by the owner of the barn. The first night Zuzu spent with us in bed, she literally scurried between my legs, onto my belly, up my chest, right over my face and head. She learned remarkably quickly from my reactionary body language alone that it was not appropriate to walk on a human's face, and so simply, intuitively, she stopped doing that. Quickly, she learned to ride the wave of my body, so to speak. When I slept on my side, she tucked herself into the space against my belly, my slightly raised knees. And when I would turn to the other side of my body, she'd climb over as we turned in perfect synchronization, never risking the loss of our shared symbiotic body warmth, never once disturbing my own state of rest. It was a nightly dance we did, Zuzu Petals and I, and the only dancing partner I ever had who accepted my lack of grace and staccato-like herky-jerky movements unconditionally. In fact, it was total, unequivocal, unconditional love for me that she had, Miss Zuzu Petals. I do pity people who haven't experienced enough of life with an animal to ever realize that these beings are capable of love. It especially irks me to hear some people say that it's we owners of cats and dogs and gorillas who understand English who want to believe that what we think is love is just a kind of Skinnerian or Pavlovian behavior exhibited by the creatures just because they want to get fed. It's their shallowness and their Skinnerian modified behavior, the people, that moves them to believe it is their pathetic lives living out what they believe to be God's intended human domain over all animals. It's they who laugh at our rage when we react to labeling us as the cat's owner. I was gratefully and forever appreciatively Zuzu Petals, human, not her owner. She was in every possible respect my dear family member. There was at least an owning up to I had to face, as most humans do. And that was the unbearably painful decision to have Zuzu Petals euthanized. The word's prefix itself is a telling sign of the euphemism it is. I decided her fate. I put her down. I had her killed. To avoid the passive tense, which we're always told in high school, I killed my beloved Zuzu Petals, the one and only being in the universe that cherished beyond anything else in life, simply being with me. What in this universe gave me the right to make that decision? I don't know. And if we humans have any claim to superiority over other beings with whom we share this earth, it's only one of a custodial nature. We take control, or try to, or think we do. And so, on Tuesday, December the 16th, 2014, a veterinarian from the animal hospital and a vet technician came to our house, Zuzu Petals' house, as compassionately as they could, to inject my dear 22-year-old precious fellow being with a lethal dose that, within seconds, sent her off to I don't know where. wife and I spent the day before and the day of her end remembering the first day we saw her. We got to the adoption center, in this case a pet supply store, too late. We had heard that an all-orange male tabby kitten was among the litter. In 1992, 22 years ago, just days before we saw Zuzu Petals, we lost our dear Magic Cat, a tabby, female, all orange. It's rare for a female cat to be all orange, but somehow we thought we could replace the hole in our hearts and our lives because of Magic's passing, and so naively, we sought a feline who at least looked like Magic. But we were late, and the orange tabby had been adopted. When we got to the store, there was just one cat left. The runt of the litter was all that was left. That was to be Zuzu Petals. The adoption center staffer, a heavy-set young woman, as I recall, saw our displeasure, our disappointment. She saw our awareness of being late that lost us the chance to adopt the orange tabby male we thought we needed to relieve the overwhelming feeling of loss we were suffering because of Magic's death. This woman kept us from walking out of that center without the runt of the litter, the last unwanted kitty. She told us that it was this cat, this cute tortoiseshell female, who was the spunkiest, the cutest of the lot, and she said was her favorite, and that we wouldn't leave without adopting this runt. We shouldn't leave without adopting her. I looked at my wife, and I saw that she was much more open to the idea than I was, and I said, "She'll do." My wife has joked about the remarkable understatement of my response, "She'll do." Whether that adoption staffer was telling the truth or not, there was no way my wife and I could repay her. There is no way we could repay her for convincing us to take what turned out to be one of the most unstoppable loving creatures that has graced this planet. We were seconds away from leaving with no cat, but I left with the love of my life, Zuzu Petals. A couple of years after adopting Petals, the mindless haste that infects most of us focused on the prized married couples. We each, my wife and I, left the house for our respective jobs, forgetting we locked Miss Petals in the bedroom closet. We trapped her without food, without water, and maybe the worst thing for any cat, without a place to relieve herself. Well, there was no way Zuzu Petals could have found food, and no way for her to have found water. But she'd have nothing to do with accepting not having a place to defecate and pee. She took a shoebox with no lid and somehow removed the shoes that were inside it. Then she reached or jumped high enough in the closet to grab and secure a couple of pawfuls of my finest silk neckties. She then lined the empty shoebox with the ties and did her business on my Burberrys, Cardans, Gansinis, and Laurens. How can you be angry with a critter creative enough to construct her own restroom exclusively from the materials from within about 3 square feet in total darkness. While Zuzu didn't use all of my ties, her stunning act of ingenuity was more than enough to motivate me to swear off the wearing of these corporate torture devices for the rest of my life. She gave me those ties. She gave those ties. She gave those ties exactly what they deserved. It was then that Miss Zuzu Petals became a sort of heroine to me. And like all good heroine, she became addicting. We became addicted to each other. Each night, she read all the cues, all the signals, and knew when I was getting ready for bed. She'd wait, Zuzu, sitting in front of my propped-up pillow, staring at the white linen pillowcase, like a monk in Zazen in lotus pose, gazing in trance at the blank white wall. Then my coming into bed was her nirvana. By the way I approached the bed, the manner I pulled away the corner of the sheets and blankets, she knew exactly how to move to allow me in under the bedding, and then without fail, she'd find the little hollow I always made for her in the array of blankets, sheets, and comforter and duvet. She'd find the opening of these tinted linens and snake her way in under the covers and against my body. I loved to watch Miss Zuzu zigzag into the cave-like shelter which we both shared each night for 22 years. As she aged, her kidneys failed. For the last 8 years, I administered 100 milliliters of subcutaneous fluid twice a day. That therapy seemed to stop all ill effects of failing kidneys. Zuzu just kept on going. It was October 10th, 2012, when Zuzu Petals suffered the first of her 33 grand mal seizures. Every 22 days on average, she lived through these violent attacks of severe, uncontrollable writhing and shaking. I'm so fortunate to have been able to hold her in my arms for 30 of those seizures while she was having them. I'd hold her close to my chest to steady her. 3 of those times, Zuzu's sharp teeth bit through whatever shirt or sweater I wore at the time, and her mouth locked shut onto my garments. My wife and I'd have to wait till all the shaking was through and until all of her urine left her bladder, usually onto my clothes. Then when she was totally spent of every ounce of energy, we were able to unlock her jaws and remove her from the fabric of my clothes. Being covered in her pee was nothing compared to the anguish her body experienced each time she had a grand mal seizure. I was confident and pleased that I was there to steady her and protect her from what could have been irreparable injury each time. Seizures, and each time, after a half hour or so, Zuzu Petals would get up, walk around, look for her food bowl, and carry on as if nothing had happened. I've known no other being on this planet who was as equanimous as old Zuzu petals. Her drive and constant ability to live in the present moment has been and will continue to be inspirational to me. On Tuesday night, December the 16th, Dr. Mitsuko, the vet, and her technician, Ginger, came to the house just around 8 p.m. We felt at least some comfort in that Ginger, an incredibly inwardly beautiful woman who cheerfully and confidently extends the necessary hope her young but cancer-ridden husband needs to survive. Her husband, an Army veteran, has bone cancer and it spread to his brain, and now he too, like our Zuzu petals, suffers from seizures. Ginger had cared for Zuzu petals a number of times here at the house in Burbank, on the occasions when my wife and I had to be away from our home for an extended period. She knew Zuzu petals, and Miss Petals knew her. That was comforting. Still harboring terrible doubts about going through with this terrible ordeal, this decision. My wife coming very close to a full-blown panic attack. Dr. Mitsuka diagnosed Zuzu petals for us and made it very clear that we were not making this literally life and death decision prematurely. Given Zuzu's state, it was time for sure. Now, it was time. I sat on the bed, our bed, Zuzu's bed. I sat in lotus position. Dr. Mitsuka gave me a couple of large, old, absorbent towels she used on these missions, the real Mission Impossible. My wife picked up Zuzu petals and put her on the pile of soft, absorbent towels that rested on my lap. For the entire 30 to 40 minutes, Dr. Mitsuka and Ginger conversed with us in this bedroom. Zuzu petals remained seemingly oblivious to us. She purred with every loving stroke any one of us gave her, but she never raised her head to look at any of us. Then, when the time came to do the deed, she became restless. She meowed and complained vocally with our repositioning of her. She knew something was different about whatever procedure was about to befall her. She became agitated and uncooperative. I insisted we wait again until she was calm, and that is what we did. Finally calm, resting in the hammock sling above the hollow of my indenture of lotus pose, in the towels between my cross legs. Zuzu petals rested calmly. Dr. Matsuka told us exactly what she was about to do, and then did just that. She pulled out a syringe loaded with powerful sedatives. She found a soft spot near Zuzu's hind legs and injected her. She said Zuzu would complain, and she did. She did just that. Zuzu grumbled vocally with a pinch of the needle. Within about a minute, Zuzu Petals was sedated enough to have surgery performed on her. We waited about 20 minutes till Zuzu was limp and almost lifeless, even without the drug that would, in a matter of seconds, take her life. The only movement for which she was capable was her extremely slow expansion and contraction of her ribs from inhaling and exhaling. Dr. Matsuka explored Zuzu's inner thigh of her hind left leg. Ginger, assisted by moving Petal's left leg that would have obstructed the view Dr. Matsuka so vitally needed to proceed in this delicate operation. I turned the green glass globe on my night table up all the way so more light could be shown on Zuzu. Matsuka then applied a clear solution that smelled somewhat like alcohol onto the area of Zuzu's inner thigh where Dr. M assumed a major vein would be. Almost magically, the solution raised what was just moments ago a nearly imperceptible vein that ran vertically under the surface of the skin of Zuzu's left inner thigh. Matsuka applied more magic solution, and then the vein swelled until its location was undeniable. Dr. Matsuka slowly and carefully inserted a needle attached to a clear tube into the vein. To be sure she in fact had entered a vein, she withdrew some of Petal's blood into the tube. Then, along with the drug that would ultimately kill Zuzu Petals, she slowly delivered the dose which followed behind the withdrawn blood Matsuka just took out of Zuzu and into the clear tube. My eyes followed the route of this terminating solution. I traced the trajectory from the syringe into the clear tube, reaching Zuzu's blood, and then watched the blood and the drug turn through the curves of the tube to the needle and into Zuzu's bulging vein. Then I watched Zuzu's breath. In, out, in, out, then no more. less than 5 seconds, Zuzu Petals was gone. One meaning of the word nirvana is exhale. I hope Zuzu Petals experienced the other meanings of that word, nirvana, upon her last exhale. She died like she lived, on our bed, attached to my body. We waited for something none of us could identify. We knew, too, that we'd each be oblivious to whatever the hell it was. We each knew we'd never know if it hit us in the face. After the euthanasia, Dr. Mizuka, Ginger, my wife and I spoke softly in the living room while one lone candle flickered on our bedroom dresser a few feet away from Zuzu Petals. Goodbye, my dear Zuzu Petals. You will always be loved. Bon voyage. Was one ending, of course, this week, and a very personal thing that happened to us, and it was very difficult. Been a very difficult week. Besides the event I described, which was the actual euthanasia, putting Zuzu down for the last time, there was something else that happened, actually, including yesterday and today. The euthanasia was on Tuesday. Yesterday we took Zuzu Petals to the crematory. And now being a night after the euthanasia, the old doubts started to coming back. Did we do the right thing? Did we take her life too soon? How could we know? Could she tell us? Is there a way we could know? We were both very upset, my wife and I. And we wanted so much for an answer. We wanted an answer. And my wife was very upset, of course. We were both upset, but she was almost in a state of panic at one point, driving from the crematory, and then she sort of zoned out in a way afterwards, where she was couldn't handle any more emotions and just kind of shut down. She described it later as kind of the same way a house electricity system will kick off the trippers and shut down because too much is going through. And that's how she was yesterday, after we left the crematory, and had great doubts about if we did the right thing. Is Zuzu alone? Is she feeling poorly? Is she feeling any sorrow? Is she wondering what happened? Well, this morning I went to pick up the remains of Zuzu Petals, and on my way back, upon returning and showing Cheryl the ceremonial box that the ashes are in and so forth. We found a nice place on the shelf in the bedroom to put the box, and a little paw print that we got for her. It's Zuzu's actual paw print. And we put them on a nice place by the lit candle, the candle that has been lit ever since she died, and it is still lit by those remains. And I left the room, and then my wife called out to me from the room and said, where did this book come from? This book. And I said, what book? I don't know what you're talking about. And she said, there's a book that's on our bookshelf, and it's facing the room. It's not spine out like all the other books, but the cover of the book is facing the room. And I said, I don't know, what book is it? She said, it's called The Spiritual Practice Through Poetry. And she asked me if I had got that book and if I had put it out. Well, I did. I do remember buying that book a few years ago and just looking at it as is my habit. Sometimes I have more books that I've bought than I've more than I've read. And this was one of them that I bought a few years ago. I don't remember putting it face out to the room, but I guess I did. And it was facing out. And as it turns out, it was very near where we put this little shrine, if you will, for Zuzu petals. And Cheryl said, this is very strange. She said, because while you were gone to get Zuzu petals, I was on the internet looking for some sort of a spiritual practice for me. My wife is not religious. She has great trouble thinking about mystical things that have happened to me and usually tries to explain them away scientifically. But she said this is the kind of time in one's life when there's some need for a spiritual practice. And I said, yeah, so what's strange? She said, well, while you were out, I was looking for poetry readings, to go to poetry readings to experience something that to me, to my wife, would be valuable, significant poetry. And she said, and then this book is just here. And I said, well, we said we wanted answers. We want to know. So as we did together, we just opened the book, and the first page we turned to was 217. And we just did that randomly. And on page 217 was this poem. And it was very, very apropos to wanting to get answers from Zuzu petals. Now, the poem is about a dog. It's called The House Dog's Grave, excuse me, by Robinson Jeffers. And this is the poem that we just randomly went to on page 217 today, The House Dog's Grave. I've changed my ways a little. I cannot now run with you in the evenings along the shore, except in a kind of dream. And you, if you dream a moment, you see me there. So leave a while the paw marks on the front door where I used to scratch to go out or in, and you'd soon open. Leave on the kitchen floor the marks of my drinking pan. I cannot lie by your fire as I used to, on the warm stone, nor at the foot of your bed. No, all the nights through I lie alone. But your kind thought has led me less, but your kind thought has laid me less than 6 feet outside your window, where firelight so often plays, and where you sit to read, and I fear often grieving for me. Every night your lamplight lies on my place. You, man and woman, live so long. It is hard to think of you ever dying. A little dog would get tired living so long. I hope that when you are lying under the ground like me, your lives will appear as good and joyful as mine. No, dears, that's too much hope. You are not so well cared for as I have been, and never have known the passionate, undivided fidelities that I knew. Your minds are perhaps too active, too many-sided. But to me, you were true. You were never masters, but friends. I was your friend. I loved you well and was loved. Deep love endures to the end and far past the end. If this is my end, I'm not lonely. I'm not afraid. I'm still yours. So I think we did get our answer. And that is one, of course, big ending in this month of December. And I'll be back with you in just a minute.
Through an exclusive arrangement with Oregon Yeshe, Tibetan divination expert, Savino Veritas listeners may have their tough questions answered. Through the universal synchronicity of Manjushri, seer of all past, present, and future, Oregon Yeshe reads your questions and throws the dice for you. More importantly, he'll answer your questions based on Manjushri's guidance, which Yeshe will invoke for your reading. The price? $22. Submit $22 to PayPal and one well-thought-out question to tjsavino22@gmail.com.
Should I go to college or not?
What's the best way to advertise my business?
Can I trust my boyfriend to be faithful?
What's the best month for the wedding?
Will I ever get pregnant?
Who's the best candidate to fill a supervisor's job? May I count on my best pitcher to win this game?
How much should I gamble at the casino?
Do I need to go see the doctor about this condition?
Is Atlanta the right place for me to move?
Should we increase our homeowner's insurance?
If I get the job, will it help our relationship?
Will marital therapy keep us together?
Where should I look for my lost ring?
Will I ever find it?
Can I?
Should he?
Should he?
Will they?
Will they?
When will?
Can?
Questions.
Questions.
Money.
Love.
Friendship.
Mo.
Mo. Tibetan divination.
So if you do have a question for which you are struggling and cannot find an answer, you can use Mo. Unbeknownst to my wife, I did as well in this situation. And got results that were pretty accurate to the way I described things for you earlier. So if you have a question that you can't answer, you can go to tjsavino22@gmail.com, PayPal, $22, but send me at that email address the question. I will send it over to Oregon Yeshe, and he will roll the Tibetan dice, and answer that one question. So I hope you take out the opportunity to do that. Another ending this week is from the HBO program, The Newsroom. And that was a show that I really enjoyed. And I enjoyed all three seasons. It kind of was like 2.5 seasons. The last season was just 6 episodes. And the first season was the best, I thought. Now, one of the things that happened with the show, in my opinion, is that they took to heart too much of the criticism that they were being one-sided against the white wingers in the United States. So the first season, in my opinion, they pulled no punches, took no prisoners. They called things the way they were. We're going to listen to some cut from the first season's episode. Episode 4 of the first season. And you'll see what I mean by the tone and what they were trying to do that they received much criticism from the right about, especially Tea Party people.
Jim was working all New Year's Eve on stories we either missed or didn't pay enough attention to in 2010.
Not all New Year's Eve. He found some time to take a little break.
Pardon?
Nothing.
We'll do 5 minutes a night every night this week. I've boiled them down to these, and Will, you can boil them down to what you want.
I'm out there on the front lines fighting for civility.
You picked her up at a party.
I didn't pick her up. I walked up. And can I say in my defense, did you see her legs?
All right, that'll do. First up, the Chilean miners.
We stuck with the Christine O'Donnell debate in Delaware instead of cutting away at the rescue.
I'll let everyone know that they came out all right.
You're the one who wanted these. Next.
Next.
I wouldn't mind following up on the bribery charges Nigeria filed against Cheney.
Next.
Conflict of interest with Virginia Thomas and a voicemail message she
Next.
Sent.
Next.
Tess? No, I'm frightened to say it.
Say it.
May 27th, the iPad was released. Lines went around the block to be able
Get
to...
the hell out of the meeting.
Yeah.
Sit down.
Where are the real ones? The lies. Lies. Why doesn't the news ever call a lie a lie, but we know it's a lie?
Now, that right there was one of the reasons I really enjoyed Newsroom. When I watched Newsroom that first season, I was remembering what newsrooms were, what news was. Real news. Where they did call a lie, and they put people, held people accountable for what they say. And that day seems to be gone. And that's what I did love about Newsroom. Let's see if I could, I hope I can continue back on that track where I was. Let's see.
Jim Maggie.
It was during the week of the midterms, so we were doing other things, but the idea that Obama spent $200 million a day on a trip to India is still in the water supply. We could deconstruct how that happened.
Sold. What else?
Guns.
What about them?
Everyone from Wayne LaPierre to Glenn Beck is shouting that Obama's coming to get our guns when there's no evidence to suggest that Obama's least bit interested in our guns.
Show me the lack of evidence and I'm in.
Anything else?
Yes. I don't know how else to say this. Bigfoot is
great.
Not because they don't want to limit your rights, but because they're afraid of the political consequences.
Coming back to you, Will.
Don't doubt for a minute that if they thought they could get away with it, they would ban guns and ban ammunition.
That was former Governor Sarah Palin speaking to the National Rifle Association last year. Here's Fox News host Glenn Beck on the same subject.
177.
He will slowly but surely take away your guns.
And here's NRA Executive Vice President Wayne LaPierre speaking at CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Conference.
But it's a big, fat, stinking lie. Just like all the other lies that have come out of this corrupt administration. It's all part.
But
you put this guy on the list of the top 10 craziest people in politics?
That's top list of crap.
Yeah, I know this looks like a big, juicy ribeye to you, but show some restraint now and let the facts speak for themselves.
Any other tips?
Try not to get distracted by his legs. Here we go.
That's their agenda.
And radio host Rush Limbaugh has repeatedly warned his listeners to go out and buy guns before President Obama outlaws them all. The result? In November 2008, the month Mr. Obama was elected, there was a 42% spike in gun background checks as compared to the same month the year before. The country's largest anti-gun lobby is called the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence, named for James Brady, President Reagan's press secretary, who was shot in the head during John Hinckley's assassination attempt on the 40th president. The Brady Organization gives grades to elected officials based on their record and leadership with regard to gun legislation, with an A being the most anti-gun, and so on. In spite of Governor Palin, Glenn Beck, Rush Limbaugh, and the director of the NRA telling us emphatically that Barack Obama has a secret plan to get our guns, here's the president's report card. Background checks, F. Gun trafficking, F. Guns in public, F. Federal assault weapons ban, F. Standing up to the gun lobby, F. Not only has no attempt whatsoever been made to dismantle the Second Amendment during Barack Obama's first 2 years in office, the president has signed into law more repeals of federal gun policies than George W. Bush did during his entire 8 years in the White House. In fact, these grades would indicate that President Obama is the best friend the NRA has ever had in elected office, to say nothing of the Oval Office. Why are Sarah Palin, Glenn Beck, Rush Limbaugh, and the head of the NRA so colossally lying to you? I don't know. But I know when they do, ratings go up, political contributions go up, membership in the NRA goes up, the president's approval rating goes down, and gun sales go through the freaking roof. We'll be right back.
You need to get used to dating a guy who gets off work at 9 o'clock.
Hey, not dating? One day.
No, stop it.
Maggie,
it's
I'm not
fine.
It's not
the... So the point is, why didn't a real newsroom say the things that this character said? Because that was all true. All we heard were the right side, the Tea Party side. It's all we ever hear. And we never hear the facts. I was listening to a speech today from Al Franken, who said everyone's entitled to their opinion, but you are not entitled to your own facts if they are against the truth. You're entitled to opinions. You're not entitled to fabricate facts. And the news should report that. That's what I think. Now, in the LA Times... published something I wrote about this, and what I was responding to in the LA Times, this was in August, late August, early September of 2013, and that some journalists had wrote to the LA Times about how the television show Newsroom was not authentic. You know, it was not like a real newsroom. It was they were pontificating. They weren't being like a real newsroom. And this is what I wrote. Each of the real-life journalists who has criticized the program for pontificating seems to have missed the fact that the HBO program is a drama. As a drama, it has, more last season than this, presented viewers with an inconvenient truth about American journalism since the Reagan days, an era that saw the death of the Fairness Doctrine and other regulations designed to keep corporados in check. That a fiction can deliver, via spectacle, truth about our society, seemingly better than journalists can present facts about a news story these days. These news people putting down the newsroom for not being enough like a newsroom are like a bunch of merchandisers bashing Death of a Salesman for not celebrating peddlers who do meet their revenue quotas. Now, that I missed that about the newsroom, because as the seasons went on, they became less strong. They apparently have bent to the wills of the Tea Party, I think. Here's another little bit of an episode of another season. No, this is still the first season, and you'll get that feel of strength and truth against lies.
I'm going to start to walk up to people more.
I got you a drink. Now, you seem lonely and broken to me.
I do.
But don't worry, I can fix you.
Well, if there's one thing a man likes, it's a woman who tries to fix him. What are you working on right now?
Piece on Brittany Giancarlo.
I don't know who that is.
Brittany Giancarlo? She's the young one on Real Housewives of New Jersey.
Oh, I got them all T-boned with it.
She's a drunk gold digger who's probably cheating with her yoga instructor.
Why are you writing about it?
I just told you.
No, I mean, sure, but what did she do?
Nothing. It's just a takedown piece.
A what?
A takedown piece. I'm going to take her down.
Why?
Because that's what you do in a takedown piece, genius.
You actually call it a takedown piece? No, it could still go well.
Not if you
don't. Oh, I think we both know that.
Didn't I just spend the last 6 months down the Tea Party?
Okay, first, thanks for watching. Second, I obviously didn't take them down. They won. Third, the fact that they did is an enormous danger to A, a great political party, of which I happen to be a member, and B, an enormous danger to everyone who lives in this country. Mm-hmm. Fourth, these are people who are asking for our votes.
You and I do the same thing for a living.
That's nuts, Nina. I try to expose the truth about things that are of national importance.
Well, I'm trying to expose the truth about the fact that Brittany might have had a daughter when she was a teenager, who's now 10 possibly, and being taken care of by her mother.
Why is that the concern of anyone except for Brittany?
It's not
the
a
hypothetical
concern.
Daughter,
it's everything.
Okay, well, here's the thing, though. It shouldn't.
Is that right?
Of course it's right. You know it's right.
Says you were like this.
No, you can be part of the change. You don't have the right gossip.
I work for a gossip magazine. Are we going to go back to flirting, or are you going to be putting me down?
I'm not putting you down. I'm just saying that what you do is a really bad form of pollution, and it's just dumber and meaner, and it's destroying civilization. I'm saying, with all possible respect, that I would have more respect for you if you were a heroin dealer. And I'm speaking professionally, not personally.
Okay, well, I'm speaking personally when I say fuck you, and you just guys never show anything.
Come on, no, wait, hear me out. I realize that people shouldn't be used as entertainment. You can turn
I'm
this thing around.
What do you think he's doing?
Trying to civilize her.
But that's not going to work out well.
Hang on. Looks like he's coming any second.
You're on right now.
There it is.
Well. Yeah.
So Jeff Daniels playing Will McAvoy, the anchorman at ACN Network, really says it the way it is. He tells it like it is, and that was the first season. But then it gets a little sentimental in the second season. It's my piece in the LA Times was was talking more about the second season. But there were journalists who were complaining that the show was not accurate. But then the show did move on. I always liked it. I still liked it to the end, but it did kind of get watered down. And here's a scene from the final episode of the finale of the show, where the Charlie, the kind of a very pivotal character who was a really great character throughout the show. He had died the episode before, and they're at his funeral, and it gets a little sentimental. But here is that scene.
How are you doing?
My grandfather died.
Well, you know, kid, I'm sorry, but I got my own problems. My best friend died.
Wait a second. You think there's a chance we're talking about the same person?
You know we are.
Where's your brother, Bo?
He's probably in the garage. He's always there. He's got a band.
Would you take me to him?
Sure.
Bo.
Hey, hello.
Place looks great.
Thanks. We're pretty good. Not great, but maybe one day.
Yeah? You mind?
No. That's right. You play guitar on the side.
I'm a news anchor on the side.
Listen, can I ask you something?
Sure.
Between the time he had the heart attack and the time he died, do you think he would have been in a lot of pain?
You know, that's exactly the kind of question he'd have asked. They'd have sedated him.
You think he was scared?
I wasn't there. When it happened, I wasn't there. I know a song you like.
If you love somebody enough, you follow wherever they go. That's how I got to Memphis. That's how I got to Memphis. If you love somebody enough, you'll go where your heart wants to go. That's how I got to Memphis. That's how I got to Memphis. Can you play that thing?
Yeah.
Go to the five.
I know if you've seen her, you'd tell me, cause you are my friend. I've got to find her, find out the trouble she's in.
Jim Harper's here.
If you tell me she's not here, I'll follow the trail.
It's a nice song, and if it got any more sentimental or hopey, then it would become a musical. They'd start dancing and so on. So, I did enjoy the show throughout. The first season was definitely the best, and they were telling it like it is. And we want to tell it like it is here on the Savino Veritas. That's what the show is, Savino Veritas, telling it like it is, I hope. And we are coming to you not from Memphis, but from Burbank, California. And it is time now for real news from the Canadian area. Phil Hong, tell us what's going on, please.
Steve Pellegrini says escalating costs created a pressing need for the increases, but Parks and Recreation Director Chris Fasciano claims revenues have risen, along with costs. A Mississauga resident is facing drunk driving charges. Police charged Neil Hector with impaired driving, resisting arrest, and driving with a suspended license after a crash on Highway 410. And the town of Caledon has gone mobile. The town has released a new app that lets smartphone users look up information on town news, events, and developments on council. Flurries possible in the forecast, plus one at Pearson, zero in Newmarket, and minus one in Mississauga. This update is brought to you by Holiday Program. Frank, Carlene, Ray, and Sky, they're all on the Holiday Program mix on SRN1. I'm Philip Hong from the SRN National News Center. Now back to Savino Veritas with Tom Savino on SRN1.
Thank you, Phil. And there's a piece here about, because this is the time of the year when we remember things, and there is a people that are dedicated to remembering, and they have a month that's called anyway in the language of the Kwanese, which is the native tongue of the split-tongued Aboriginal tribe from Australia's bush. Their word for retrospect is Membuwe Puntanko Mimi. Like all tribes of the bush, Kwanini's year is based on the lunar calendar, 13 months, and so they have their November, December, followed by, remember, the 13th month. Like the infantilization of modern urban women, who remove much, if not all, of their genital hair, in Australia, there's little left of the bush. Surviving Kwaninis, many of whom are forced to live in cities so foreign to their natural way of life, and who work as airport security agents or dancing sign carriers, still try to gather for the month-long Mumbuwe Puntongomimi Festival each remember. With the help of a Kwanini interpreter, Savino Veritas radio show reporters spoke with tribe elder Umbonio Segwe, which means the great recaller, now working in a Foster's beer can manufacturing plant in Sydney. Veritas, thank you for taking the time to speak with us, Umbonio.
Time cannot be taken except in dream time, where time is fluid and can be put in containers to be enjoyed later, but only in dream time where there is no later, like in what you call real time. I put my time in empty Foster beer cans.
So, in real time, there is no later, or is it in dream time that there is no later?
The latter.
Umbanio?
You may call me
Tell us about Remember, the 13th month of the Kwanese calendar.
Each of our months has 28 days. Even in your language, the word month comes from the word moon, yet you insist upon ignoring the connection between this earth and the moon. Yet some of you wear lunar wristwatches designed, you say, to measure time.
Remember is our 13th month.
Each remember we gather in the bush, or like the infantilization of modern urban women and their genital hair, what's left of the bush.
Do you all gather in a public place?
No, in a pubic place, a bush, friend. No, just joking. Yes, we gather. We gather in a public place, the place of dream time.
Can you describe the place of dream time?
It's a large open field, once called the Field of Dream Time, until Universal Studios threatened to sue us for copyright infringement. In the place of dream time, we spend the 28 days of remember, communing as a tribe, dancing in trance state, and what you people say, getting him together.
Well, I think you mean getting it together, yes?
No, I mean getting him together. We are very literal people. Each January, we sacrifice an elder who's pretty much losing it anyway. In a ritual with the elements of fire, water, and earth, and air, we dismember him and bury his disengaged parts in deep holes dug throughout the Field of dream time. Then, during the festival, we dig him up, find all his parts, and place his skeletal remains together as anatomically accurate as possible. We remember him.
Who was the elder you sacrificed last January?
I can't remember. But today, with most of our tribe working in our big western cities with the only time overtime, it's difficult to practice Mumbuwe Putankameme. First of all, the modern man has no remember. So we have to figure out when our remember falls on your insane 12-month calendar. Then we have to get together all the tribe who are now scattered here and there all over Australia.
Wow, that's a sort of remembering in and of itself, getting the tribe together. What shamanic method do you use to communicate with all the tribe?
Twitter. We tweet the time and place.
We have to rent a hall usually, but between us, we never tell the management we're bringing the skeletal remains of the elder
municipal health calls and all. And thank you. Thank you for this interview. But we're running out of time. Oh, you can't run out of time because... Yes, thanks. But what's next from Umbaniao Segawai? Which means great recaller. I've been offered a job at General Motors. Additionally, I'm manufacturing wristwatches showing the phases of the moon and featuring a 13-month calendar. Well, what are they called? They're called Lunar Ticks, and you could get them on Amazon. Well, that was an exclusive interview with the elder of the Kwanese people in this time of remembrance. And finally, tonight is the finale of someone who I really admire, greatly admire, and aspire to being like in terms of certain of his qualities, his humor, especially his satire. And that, of course, is Stephen Colbert. So as you're listening to Sabina Veritas, the last episode of Colbert will air tonight. Now, this is a happy ending because he is going to host Late Night on Channel 2, taking over the place with David Letterman, and I look forward to that. I am curious as to what he's going to do and how he's going to do it, since he has a persona that he is famous for, the persona of Stephen Colbert, as being a conservative person. Of course, that is the satire. Let's listen to some of his cuts in the last few days just to get a good taste of what he does.
Thank you so much, Ravina. Good to have you with us, folks. I got to tell you, folks, thank you. Thank you so much for that welcome, because tonight I am beside myself with anger, and he's mad too. Because yesterday, Senate Democrats dropped a turd of information into the national punch bowl of bliss.
Explosive report. The Senate reveals CIA secrets about torturing terror suspects.
The report written by Senate Democrats says the CIA overstated the program's successes while hiding its horrors.
It is a damning indictment.
It is damning indeed.
Yes, a damning report about enhanced interrogation. The program was started under President Bush, if you'll recall. And if you won't recall, the CIA has ways of making you. All right? It's all detailed. It's all detailed in this 500-page travesty, which spills sensitive torture secrets and reads like 50 shades of legal gray areas. Yeah. All right. Spicy stuff. Oh, yeah. There's a little bondage. Jim?
American interrogators punched, shackled, dragged, and nearly drowned Al-Qaeda operatives.
The sexual humiliation of prisoners and even torturing detainees after the CIA determined there was no more information to be gained.
Detainees were kept in total darkness and given buckets for human waste.
Abu Zubaydah, a top Al-Qaeda associate, spent a total of 266 hours in a large coffin-sized confinement box.
And this is not pleasant to recount, but many instances of so-called rectal rehydration.
I just gotta shake, 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 shake. Shake it off. Just shake it off.
Sorry, you should probably get a pair of these tragedy-canceling headphones. Really makes it better. Now, folks, I gotta ask, what is the point of telling us all this rough stuff? No one still thinks that it's ever okay to do something like this.
For the record, I still think it's okay to do something like this as long as it's done in a fair way. I think the torture, the enhanced interrogation techniques, I think they serve.
So Eric is in favor of torture. I'm sorry, torture. This is very important. If it's done in a fair way, you know, as long as they bring enough human waste buckets for everyone in the secret prison. I am with Fox's Andrea Tantaros, who is stoked for America, come whatevs.
The United States of America is awesome. We are awesome. But we've had this discussion. We've closed the book on it and we've stopped doing it. And the reason they want to have this discussion is not to show how awesome we are. This administration wants to have this discussion to show us how we're not awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what they want. That's what they want. But we are awesome, and we have to be awesome, because the people we're fighting are totally radical. And that's why we had to resort to extreme measures. Seriously, things got pretty gnarly. We shocked a bra. Besides, all of this is ancient history.
We know it's bad, but why bring it up now?
But it's been a long time since we've been doing any of this. So the need to release this document with a lot of gory details at this stage of the game is hard to find.
We're at 2014. We're talking about things that happened in 2006, 2007, 7, 8 years ago.
Yeah, it was 7, 8 years ago. I mean, the CIA was probably keeping detainees awake by blasting Feist. Come on. Still, there are some bright spots in this thing, and not just from the sparks off the jumper cables. Because America's former president and my heart's forever president, George W. Bush, comes off looking great in this thing. For example, on page 98, it says, the president of the United States had directed that he not be informed of the locations of the CIA detention facilities to ensure that he would not accidentally disclose the information. That's right. No, that's right. Because it would have been all too easy for the president to accidentally disclose this kind of intel. I mean, it's a simple slip-up anybody could make. I mean, what you mean to say is, congratulations to the world champion San Antonio Spurs, but what comes out is, we're sticking dental tools up somebody's pee hole under a Bulgarian disco. Then, of course, you have to send Tim Duncan to the disco because he knows too much. It's a mess. And, you know, what courage that willful ignorance takes. And it dates back to our founding fathers. Remember, it was George Washington who first said, and I quote, he didn't want to know what was going on either because he was torturing people too. Don't believe me? Just ask amateur historian and brown-haired guy who's not Steve Doocy or an historian, Brian Kilmeade.
When someone or some group is trying to destroy you and your way of life, you need to do whatever it takes to stop them.
George Washington did, and that's a fact. So for those of you who say that's all we're built on, we don't beat the British without doing it.
Yeah, Washington tortured the British so hard, they're still talking funny. Now, folks, yeah, that's how we did it. Now, we looked it up, and in actuality, Washington didn't torture them. But that doesn't mean he didn't. Because while the CIA was conducting an all-you-can-pump rectal hydration festival, here's what George Bush said.
The United States does not torture.
And he should know because he specifically asked not to be told. Now, another person who doesn't want to be told things is Wolf Blitzer, who yesterday blitzed Dianne Feinstein, the chairman of the Senate committee that released this report.
Was it worth it to release this report today if, in fact, American lives, whether diplomats, military personnel, civilians, are going to be in danger?
Look, there is no perfect time to release this report. There have been beheadings. There have been attacks without this report coming out.
But if Americans are killed as a result of this report and they tell you that, I assume you would feel guilty about that.
I would feel very badly, of course. I mean, what do you think, Wolf Blitzer?
Yes. What do you think, Wolf Isaac Blitzer? And don't you roll your eyes at me, young man. Now go clean your situation room or your father and I will take away your guns from you. one. As journalists, it is our sacred duty to face those in authority and ask, should we really know this? The point is, I don't want to learn what's in this report. When we return, I'm going to learn what's in this report. When I'm joined by the director of the National Security Archive at George Washington University, Tom Blanton. We'll be right back.
And that professor from George Washington University does come back and reminds everyone, by the way, and there's many more pages, like I think it's the 6,000 pages or some ridiculous number he gives, and that while the beginning of this, earlier in the Colbert cut, a Fox so-called news person says that the Democrats made this report, and it was Democrat Dianne Feinstein who was the spearhead of the report and organized the report. But all of these documents are from the CIA. It's the CIA's report. It's just gathering all the information from the CIA. Was it a Democrat who did gather them? Maybe. But it's the truth. And that's the thing that we have to be aware of. And this torture situation is very bad. I'm going to give you another funny cut from Stephen Colbert to show the hypocrisy of the right and the Tea Party people. There are some real clowns up there like Scott Walker in Wisconsin who should definitely not have elected office. And Stephen Colbert calls him on it satirically. So let's hear.
The air for the 2016 presidential election. But folks, I want you to know that does not mean I cannot call it right now. So 0% of precincts caring, the next president of the United States will be Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker. Congratulations. Scott. Well, and folks, I'm a little, they love you. I'm calling this for Governor Walker right now because he has proven that he is smarter than he looks, sounds, and governs. This man knows that if you want to get elected in this country as a Republican, you can't just appeal to white people. You also need to appeal to Jewish white people.
Remember, high-profile Republicans with sights on a 2016 presidential bid are returning from a weekend in Sin City where they addressed the Republican-Jewish coalition's annual spring gathering. Among those names, Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker.
Governor Scott Walker hoping to get the blessing and fortune of casino mogul Sheldon Adelson.
Yes, the Walker campaign wants the blessing and fortune of Sheldon Adelson, but they're not greedy. They'll settle for just the fortune. And Walker's affection for the Jewish people is genuine. In fact, Madison's The Capital Times has published a letter dating from Walker's time as Milwaukee County executive in which he tells a local Jewish leader that he would be happy to display a menorah celebrating Hanukkah at the Milwaukee courthouse, signing it, "Thank you again, and Molotov." Now, Walker probably meant Mazel Tov, which is Yiddish for congratulations, and not Molotov, which is a bottle of gasoline with a lit rag stuffed in the neck used to firebomb tanks. So there's a little difference. Though, in Walker's defense, 8 Molotov cocktails would make for a very festive menorah. They said the gas would burn for only one night. Now, I think everyone needs to just lay off Walker here. He's still learning. He hasn't yet developed the deep cultural understanding of the Jewish people that I have. There is no greater friend of the children of Israel than yours truly. So allow me to say a word on Walker's behalf. Jewish nation, Scott Walker's a good guy. He's a real munch. Okay, he doesn't wear a Yamaha or observe the sherbert. The important thing is that he was ready to display that menorah. I'm sure, given the chance, he would also have displayed the majorah. And we're not even talking about a major Jewish holiday here. It's not like this is Yom Tupac Shakur or Shana. If it weren't the same time as Christmas, no one would even talk about Hanukkah Matata. It's just a fun family holiday where you eat potato tchotchkes and you spin the dildo. Let's all just cut Scott Walker some slack. That's what the holiday season's all about. So to my Jewish viewers, I tonight raise a glass of Lenny Kravitz and say a hearty L'Heimlich maneuver. Folks, I don't want to act like I'm holier than thou. I'm from South Carolina. We say holier than y'all. This is Yahweh or no way.
I'm certainly going to miss the Colbert Report. This is Tom Savino at Savino Veritas on SRN1. And we're heard every Thursday nights at 8 p.m. Pacific time, 11 Eastern time. And next week is Christmas, and we do have a special Christmas show, and we will be having the Reverend Cheryl Kincaid, who wrote a book about Dickens' Christmas Carol and how it relates to the Gospels of the New Testament. She'll be talking about that. We will have other Dylan Thomas, Child's Christmas in Wales. So join us if you have time on Christmas evening, and we'll into, if you're on the East Coast, into Boxing Day in Canada. And we're going to end now with our show, and we're going to go out with this song in honor of Zuzu Petals, who I dedicated this show to. So see you soon next week on Christmas evening on SRN1. Savino Veritas.
This is a present from a very dear friend of mine.
Look, Daddy, teacher says, every time a bell rings, an angel gets his wings.
That's right. That's right.
Attaboy, Clarence.